this is Monocle Reads, and my guest today is Guy Speer. Originally from South Africa, after an MBA from the Harvard Business School, a first-class degree in politics, philosophy, and economics from Oxford University, he started as an investment banker in New York and a management consultant in Paris and London. Well, now he's based in Zurich, where he manages Aquamarine, a privately offered investment fund. He's also an author, and he's here today to tell us more about his book, The Education of a Value Investor. Now, Guy, we've been trying to do this in Zurich, and we never seem to coincide in the city at the same time, even though you live there. But here we are in our London studio, and it's great to have you here.
It's such a pleasure to be here. And it's funny you bring up the book. The book is now 5 years old, and so much has changed since I've written the book. And it's a strange thing for me because I put the book out there. I put myself out there in the book. And then people want to meet the person that I was 5 years ago, except I'm no longer the person I was 5 years ago.
Well, I'd quite like to know what made the person you were 5 years ago, because you had a really peripatetic childhood, didn't you? I mean, you grew up all over the world.
In many ways, actually, what I'm discovering is that children of ours are going to have a life like I already had. So I believe that I was a forerunner in that both my parents left the country of origin mainly for economic opportunity. There was a book that I read called Third Culture Children. When you grow up, when your parents have one culture, you perhaps grow up in another, and then you're in a yet another culture. And it seems to me now that much of the world is like that. I can't remember your question, but it felt like
it was
right
about where you grew up. So I know that you were in Iran, you were in South Africa, you were in Israel. Where else?
So I forgot to tell you just now, Iran. You know, I miss Iran so much. It's such a beautiful country with such amazing people, and I can't wait until it's properly free. But yes, so Iran. Before that, we were in Israel, surprisingly enough. At the time, Iran and Israel had very, very good relationship. I never really lived in South Africa. I left when I was 3 months old, but we came back on a regular basis and visited the towns of my mother's origin, which were Pietermaritzburg and Durban. And then after Iran, my parents, and I think that probably many Monocle 24 listeners think of this, my mother was from South Africa. My father was from Israel, and they were deciding where to go from Iran. And they picked the UK as a kind of neutral territory, a place where they could both move to. And so we were immigrants to the UK, and I was 11 years old at the time. The amazing thing now is that I've actually lived a relatively short portion of my life in the UK, even though I have a British accent. Mm. I left when I was about 22 years old, in a certain way, I no longer saw myself as limited by national boundaries. I wanted to have a career and a life where a national boundary was more like a boundary between two neighborhoods. And sometimes people tell me, you haven't yet asked the question, but I'll ask it for you. They say, yeah, but where are you from? And one of the ways I try to answer that is I tell them, imagine you know somebody who was born in Brooklyn, grew up in Manhattan, and now lives in New Jersey. It would be a little ridiculous to ask them, but where are you from, Brooklyn, Manhattan, or New Jersey? They're from all three, and really, does it matter? And I feel like that's the world that I actually want to live in, is one where those national boundaries don't matter. And funnily enough, well, the funny thing is, if you take Manhattan, people said, well, what's it like to live in the United States? I spent 16 years in Manhattan. And what I used to tell people is, well, actually, I don't really live in the United States. I live in this very narrow boundary, which is about two blocks around Central Park and maybe a little bit of Soho and Tribeca. And that was it. And those areas have more in common with, say, certain parts of London, certain parts of Zurich, certain parts of Tokyo. And so really, maybe now I've lived in those places. That's not true of where I grew up. So Pietermaritzburg is not part of that global world. The neighborhood where we lived in Tel Aviv is a lower class or lower middle class neighborhood with high-rise apartment buildings and not the nice apartment buildings. We live there. It's an area called Mars Aviv. And so those were not the kind of Tony parts of town or the kind of global outlook parts of town. But now where I live, I guess, it's still a global outlook. So, and I feel there's so much in common both with Monocle readers and with other people who've lived even in places where I've not lived, but the kinds of people who live in Palo Alto or San Francisco or certain parts of Tokyo are kind of a similar outlook.
Absolutely, a kind of global citizenship, urban global.
Having said that, you know, I feel very acutely now in the UK, and I didn't feel it up to Brexit, this sense that there's an extraordinary divide between those of us who live in that global world and those of us who are actually the people that I might meet in my daily life who live in such a different world and they don't see the world in that way. And they are extraordinarily angry.
Yeah. And well, Brexit has absolutely defined this for us, hasn't it? I mean, in the way that you're talking about your nationality, I feel I'm a Londoner, but I'm not British. And I think that a lot of people feel that way, particularly after Brexit.
There's somebody that I know who's Scottish who moved here and still has a very Scottish accent. And she will tell me that she's, and I'm not going to try and do the Scottish accent, but she'll say with the rolling her eyes, she's British, not European.
Yeah.
And something I haven't told her, because I don't think it would help the debate, is I want to tell her, well, actually, no, well, you're Scottish, you're not English. And so actually, maybe one day when Scotland does its exit, then you won't be welcome here. And when you take that ad nauseum, it just takes you to a ridiculous place.
Your book. It's called The Education of a Value Investor. I'm going to sound so ignorant now. Forgive me. What is a value investor?
Yeah, so at the time, 20 years ago, when I got into the business of investing, and before, there were people who would invest based on whim, if you like, reading charts, which stocks were going up and buy them. And there weren't that many people who actually said to themselves, let's look and see what this company is worth. What is the underlying business? What ought it to trade for? If you had a private market buyer, if this was an exchange between two private equity funds, what price would they pay for this? And the guy who really started understanding this is somebody called Ben Graham. He was probably a genius IQ-wise. He taught at Columbia Business School, and he wrote a book called The Intelligent Investor. And a small tribe of people developed who realized that this was the right way to go about investing. And they called themselves value investors. And of course, the most famous of them is Warren Buffett. And it was a very small tribe at the time. It's a much larger tribe now. And in a certain way, it's now a given that the right way to look at a publicly traded stock is to value it as if you were buying the whole business. But 20 years ago, it wasn't. And so that tribe still calls itself value investors, even though we're a much larger tribe. In fact, we're no longer a tribe. We kind of like dominate much of the market. Mm. But the title of the book is also a play on another book that a friend of mine actually had edited called The Education of a Speculator by a character that I've never met called Victor Niederhofer. And that was a loose, baggy monster of a book. But we enjoyed the title of his book and thought that it would be a fun play on the...
Now, one of the defining moments of your career was a very expensive lunch with Warren Buffett. Tell us about that.
You know, and if you would have told me 20 years ago that I would end up spending the ridiculous amount of money that I spend in order to have lunch with him, I said, absolutely no way, I'm not going to do that. That's just insanity. And the friend who proposed the idea to me, an Indian investor called Monish Pabrai, at the time that he brought it up, I said, well, that's a ridiculous idea. It's not just defining, it marks a turning point for me. And even though I started my life, my business career in not a great place, and I improved, the launch kind of was a significant inflection point to the positive. So I got to spend, it was about 3.5 hours with Warren Buffett at a very famous restaurant in New York called Smith & Walensky's. We drank Diet Cokes and ate a steak and hash browns, which is what Warren Buffett likes to eat. Monish's two daughters were there sitting to his either side. They must have been ages 7 and 11. I was there with my wife. Monish was there with his wife. I'll give you one anecdote before you decide where to dive in. You talked about my sort of like multinational background. And I'd sent Warren a bio of myself and of my wife. My wife, Laurie, was born in Salisbury, North Carolina, but then grew up in Mexico. So I kind of thought that Warren would be interested to discover that he was meeting with somebody who's got this varied background. when he met me and my wife, he went straight for her, and the part of the bio that he'd picked up on was that she was born in Salisbury, North Carolina, which happens to be where Warren has, or had a great friend, a guy called Fred Stanbacker, which is written about in various biographies of his. And so he wanted to ask Laurie, my wife, about, you know, certain streets that he'd hung out on. And unfortunately, she, being another kind of third culture kid, had been born in Salisbury, North Carolina, but grew up in Mexico, so she really didn't know much about it. And it just goes to, this guy is extraordinarily sophisticated in his thinking about the world, but at his heart, he's a Midwesterner. And in a certain way, all of that international background for Warren just passed him by. What he was excited about was somebody who knew a town the way he'd grown up.
Yeah. How did his meeting influence your life?
You know, first of all, it really taught me the power of hanging out around the right people and hanging out with people who are better than you. So in the lead up to the meeting, I knew for at least a year when it was going to be. I started feeling very angstful because my fund at the time was charging not super high fees, but high fees. Not high fees, the standard, the industry standard. But both Warren and my friend Monish, Warren is famous for charging Berkshire Hathaway a $100,000 salary to run that enormous conglomerate. He's one of the least best paid CEOs around. And Monish had copied Warren's fee structure when he was running a private partnership, which charges zero management fees. And so there I was going to show up to this lunch where I was going to be the high-priced greedy product or the representative of the high-priced greedy product. And so it made me change my fee structure before I got there. And it was a hard thing to do, but I used the lunch. Funnily enough, I just read David Cameron's memos. I know a lot of people don't want to read them, but one of the things that was really interesting that he said for me was that Prime Minister's questions is a way you can use Prime Minister's questions that will come up to get changes in government departments, because you can use that as pressure. And in a certain way, that was a kind of a pressure that I used on my advisors to get the right fee structure in place. But then, you know, the meeting with him, I was pretty arrogant, if you saw in my book. And there were still vestiges of that arrogance. And it's really hard to sit inside, when you consider yourself to be smart, it's really hard to sit in a room with somebody who's clearly smarter than you are. But so that was painful for me, because I really didn't know what it would be like. And I may have been just intimidated by all sorts of other things, but I don't think that's the case. He really is a brilliant guy. But it freed me up. It freed me up afterwards to stop trying to ape him. And so there's this sort of fine divide between having heroes and following your heroes, but also being your own person. And it's great to have heroes, but it's also great to be your own person. And I think it freed me up to say, well, you've had him as a hero, and he'll still be a hero. Stop trying to be Warren Buffett number two. And I think there's a statement in my book somewhere where I say, you know, well, Warren and Charlie, his business partner, they say, how do you beat Bobby Fischer, the famous chess player? Well, it's easy. You play him anything by chess, you know? And I think I write in my book, I was not going to do a very good job of being Warren Buffett, but I should certainly do a far better job than Warren Buffett of being Guy Spier, you know?
Absolutely.
And actually, in that regard, I just saw the quote, and it's just such a great quote. So a guy that, I don't know if you've read any Joseph Campbell. All Monocle listeners should read Joseph Campbell. He's an extraordinary guy. And so this is, if I hadn't seen this quote, I would have it in the book. The privilege of a lifetime is being who you are. Isn't that beautiful?
It is. It is very beautiful. You say that since the book came out, you have completely changed. So bring us up to speed.
The reason why we can meet today is that I left a Vipassana meditation retreat early. This is like a 10-day retreat that I was booked on and was doing in a place called Mont Soleil in Switzerland. I lasted 2 days. But, you know, in my book, in the second part of the book, I talk a lot about setting up our environment for success. And the move to Zurich was a part of that. And I talk a lot about setting up my office. And t- Tyler has not been in my office, but you would love my office. I hope you do come visit it sometime. It's got USM furniture and wood paneled rooms. It's got a library. And the library is a place where there's no electronics and I can go just sit and read and think about the world. And I make a lot about having a Bloomberg monitor because I am an investor, but the Bloomberg monitors are at a standing desk. So I try to make it uncomfortable. So I'm working really hard at creating an environment for success, but I didn't realize, and in the book, I write about how I'm not much one for meditation. I'm into psychotherapy, coaching, you name it, group therapy, forums, but I say I'm not much one for meditation. And about 5 or 6 people wrote to me and said, you should do meditation. And so I think that a big difference between the book then and who I am now is I've realized that if you talk about the inner journey, you can configure your environment how you like, and it doesn't hurt. But actually, you need to go right to the core of where you are, because everything in your life, once you get to my age at least, everything that you have around you in some way is a reflection of your thoughts. So actually, even though I left the meditation retreat early, my plan is to do a lot more meditation, a lot more. And I think I do a pretty good job of doing the inward journey, but, you know, I got 90% of the way. And we know that the last 10% may be the hardest, but may be the most interesting. And then there are some other things, like I have some ideas that I've changed. So the first part of the book is a kind of a memoir slash sort of story of the mistakes that I made. And I felt like the memoir genre has got too much look how great I am and kind of brushing the mistakes under the carpet. And I really, really wanted to show the reader that a successful life is built on the back of enormous mistakes. But then the sort of the last fifth of the book is kind of a little bit more about practical ideas about how to configure your life for success. And for example, I talk about one shouldn't speak to management. Well, I disagree with that now, for example. And it's hard for me because people who are investment analysts will come to me and say, oh, you know, it's really great. I don't speak to management teams anymore. And my answer is actually I do. Sorry. And I've actually had it in interviews like this where people are, they're not upset, but they feel like they've been slightly shortchanged. Mm. And I mean, I think somebody like me is a one book person. I am not a natural writer. I was talking to a friend before coming in here about Neil Ferguson. I mean, I admire people like Neil Ferguson because he is a true writer and he's written many great books. So I don't plan to write another book. I don't think it would be smart for me to do. But I think that I probably need to do some kind of addendum, epilogue, something, and sort of correct and maybe reissue the book with those 2 or 3 extra chapters, basically.
Many thanks to Guy Spears, and his book, The Education of a Value Investor, is available now. You've been listening to Monocle Reads with me, Georgina Godwin. Many thanks to our producer, Nora Hull, and our researcher, Giacomo Harper.